The race riot rumor in Utah began in 1965. And the rumor went something like this. Black militants, angry over the LDS Church's stance on civil rights and its priesthood ban on black people, were chartering planes, buying up weapons, and making bombs. And they were coming to Salt Lake City to take over the Mormon General Conference in October. There were a number of reasons for how a rumor like that got started. In fact, when you get a minute, go to our website and watch the short film we produced about this story, which began with an actual riot in Liberty Park in 1965, where young people who had too much to drink and things had gotten out of hand, and how that turned into the rumor about a race war in Utah. Today in the program, we're talking about that race riot rumor, about a time in Utah history where a group of Utah political conservatives used fear to discredit and weaken the growing support for civil rights. And this is a reminder of how the tactic of fear worked then and still works now. But we have to begin with Darius Gray, an African-American convert to The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We talked to his good friend Margaret Blair Young this week. She's a writer, a filmmaker, former teacher at BYU. And she told us Darius's part in this story began shortly after he became a Mormon, just a year before the rumors started.
His first Sunday in church as a baptized member, a little girl sees him, shouts the N-word, and leaves. He wonders whose child that was and who else would go along with that kind of view of him. So it's almost an immediate rebuke. He decides to come to BYU. He has no money, lives at the Roberts Hotel, and basically pays his rent monthly and has just nothing left over. And word was throughout campus that a movie called Civil Rights was going to be shown.
And I thought, well, that's great. And so on the appointed day, I went over, and I went inside, and the place was packed. Finally, the lights went down, the film came up. And instead of it being civil rights, it was civil R-I-O-T-S, riots. It was a film produced by the John Birch Society.
They want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, through out of which will come a conglomerated, a lot of mongrel class of people. Those races will be destroyed in such a movement. I, for one, under God, will die before I'll yield one inch to that kind of a movement. What about that?
And it continued to say that here is Dr. Martin Luther King at some communist training school in Tennessee. And I sat there, the only person of color in that audience. When the lights came up, the place was silent, and I could feel so many eyes on me.
That was really the final blow. And as he phrases it, he left Utah on a dead run. The big question is, why would Darius Gray come back to Utah? He got an offer from KSL Television, and Darius decided he would take the job. So he's in Salt Lake City as rumors begin. The big one is the circulation of Negroes invading Utah, invading the temple, ravishing the women, and blood flowing down the streets. The young men with their deer rifles would come and protect Zion from these Negroes.
As a reporter, I heard reports, well, they've just been seen going through Las Vegas. And, you know, how many hours is it going to be before they get to Salt Lake City? And, of course, none of it ever happened. It created an atmosphere here that was not user-friendly.
Darius was treated abominably. He couldn't cross Temple Square without being followed. And he was good friends with Dewey Phyllis, who was the police chief in Salt Lake City. But Dewey Phyllis showed Darius the plans for dealing with this invasion. you know, what spires they would have snipers on. It was a real plan because the rumor was taken very seriously.
Dewey Phyllis was a friend. He had been at my wedding. He and his wife had come to our home for dinner. We had gone to their home for dinner. He felt comfortable in showing me this. He had in his office a cot, the same sort that would be used by the guardsmen as they were in these facilities to be prepared for this influx of blacks who were going to come in and do all this harm. It was that real.
You have to realize that Darius had put everything on the line to join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the disrespect that he met is just heartbreaking.
I used to be a shooter. And I was at this one gun shop in town. And there were two men who were talking loudly enough for me to hear. And one of them said to the other, "Well, I have a temple recommend from my stake president, and I'll be in the east towers of the Salt Lake Temple." And he said, "I'll be able to pick a nigger off down Main Street for so many blocks." And then they turned to look at me to make sure I had heard. And indeed, I had heard.
Darius was absolutely certain that that was meant for him to hear. He was also deeply fearful for his own safety and that of his wife's.
There were those times when I made plans to get out of this valley for my wife, who is white, through the normal means, go to the train station, bus station, airport, but for me to be able to get out of the valley on horseback because I didn't know that I could use public transportation.
The kind of suspicion and disrespect that he received during the late 60s was just deplorable. It's amazing that he stayed. How do I explain it? I think one of the big things is the idea that God had given us permission to discriminate because you believe they're cursed. And that was how it was originally framed. Brigham Young pronounced blacks is cursed, common belief, of course, in the 19th century and earlier than that. Then you have the civil rights movement and you have church leaders making bold pronouncements against the civil rights movement and suggesting that blacks are pawns of a communist movement. So basic, what do humans allow themselves to do if they are under an authority that they respect?
We had somebody get on a plane from a certain city this weekend. And in the plane, it was almost completely loaded with thugs wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms with gear and this and that. They're on a plane.
Where is this?
I'll tell you sometime, but it's under investigation right now.
When I heard President Trump talk about thugs on airplanes, an airplane full of thugs headed towards wherever it was, my immediate thought was, I've been through this. And the appalling thing was that so many people fell for it.
What does Darius Gray think now when you are, how is he reflecting on this, if you can say?
The word I would use is frustration, disbelief that we're here again.
It's painful to see us step backward, and the tone of the country is again becoming more hateful and more fearful. And because of the tone that I hear out there, I'm not sure we're as safe as we once were.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we wanted to explore this race riot rumor today on the show. And we're going to begin with the historian Matt Harris. Because if you're going to figure out how a rumor like this gets started, Harris says you have to understand what was happening in Utah at that time. He says in the 1960s, the NAACP in the state had been lobbying for legislation that would protect people of color from housing and job discrimination. But nothing in the legislature was happening, so leaders from the organization threatened to picket LDS General Conference in 1963. Now, remember, most, if not all, of the lawmakers at the time were Mormon, and the church was denying black people the priesthood and access to the temple. So it actually made sense to picket Temple Square. And you can see how the ingredients are all there for a rumor to get started. Harris says that at the conference in 1965, an LDS apostle named Ezra Taft Benson comes into the picture. Now, Benson would eventually become president of the church, but Harris told us he was a rabid anti-communist. He'd been Secretary of Agriculture in the Eisenhower administration and a member of the ultra-conservative organization called the John Birch Society. Benson believed civil rights was a communist conspiracy. In fact, he had ideas that so alarmed other church leaders that they actually sent him away to work in Germany, hoping to temper these radical ideas. But as you can tell by his address at conference that year, it didn't work. Here's Matt Harris.
Benson says, quote, "Before I left for Europe, I warned how the communists were using the civil rights movement to promote eventual takeover of this country. When are we going to wake up? What do you know about the dangerous civil rights agitation in Mississippi? Do you fear the destruction of all vestiges of state government?"
So Harris says Benson is stoking fears about the civil rights movement being part of a large communist conspiracy. In 1965, a real riot erupts in Watts in California, and so you can see how the stage is set for this race riot to really take off. Back to Matt Harris.
The Birchers had been predicting that there would be racial unrest for years. This was in Birch literature everywhere, that we don't know where it will happen, but it will happen. Hmm. And these black Marxists are going to foment trouble in America's cities. And when the Watts riots occurred in August of 1965, they took that as proof that these sort of prophecies or predictions are coming true, that this is the beginning of a Marxist revolution and all that that entails, where the oppressed peoples of the world, in this case, black people, will rise up against their white overseers, to use a phrase. And so that's the prism or the lens by which that Benson and others are seeing this. And the NAACP people, at least in Salt Lake, we have to draw, I guess, two distinctions here. We've got a black community in Salt Lake and Ogden who have their own, you know, grievances against the church in the state of Utah for not being more progressive with civil rights. And then we've got black power advocates and agitators who live outside of the state. And when they're talking about these black power advocates, they're not talking about members of the NAACP necessarily, at least locally. They're talking about people who will come from out of state and possibly align with the Salt Lake and Ogden chapters and, you know, commit acts of violence or something.
So we have actual riots playing out in the United States in the summer of 1965. Ultra-conservatives like the John Birch Society, like Ezra Taft Benson, are concerned about that. And then this gets us to a man by the name of Reed Benson. This is Ezra Taft Benson's son. And he's a major player in this particular story. He is the regional coordinator for the John Birch Society. And he writes this memo in September of that year. And what does the memo say exactly? Give me a sense of what—and is this secret? Is it a secret memo?
Oh, yeah. He doesn't put his name to it. So his father's already under a lot of pressure for his outspoken views on civil rights, especially that 1965 sermon I just mentioned. So if Reed put his name to it, then that would just bring more trouble for his father. And so he sends this memo to the Utah chapters of the Birch Society, but it leaks out. Nobody knows who wrote it. And Reed instructs members to begin a whispering campaign and to foster rumors that the civil rights groups are going to organize in Salt Lake City. And of course, this is all in connection with the LDS conference that's coming in October. Mm-hmm. So this is like 3 weeks before that. He said that a few well-placed comments will soon mushroom out of control. And before the conference begins, there will be such a feeling of unrest and distrust that the populace will hardly know who to believe. The news media will play it to the very hilt. No matter what the civil rights leaders may try to say to deny it, the seed will have been sown, and again, the civil rights movement will suffer a telling blow. And again, it's the context that he and his father feel like they're losing ground with civil rights, that President Brown, a high-ranking church officer, had just read this pro-civil rights statement in conference, and they're losing ground. And this is a way to maybe make up some ground to plant this rumor that somehow these black militants are coming. And people will be less likely to support civil rights if they know they're going to be threatened.
It's pretty interesting to look at the memo because he, as you said, it's pretty conniving. And he mentions, as you just read, the news media will play it to the very hilt. People mm-hmm. will not know who to believe. So it's a deliberate attempt at just misleading people and stoking fear, creating hysteria, really.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. And think about this: what happened a couple of weeks before this memo circulated, which is that Watts was a significant episode in United States history. This is when folks agitated with racial inequality. Some black men were agitated with the notion that there was a disproportionate number of African-Americans being drafted in the Vietnam War. The government wasn't helping them. They felt like their neighborhood is just full of poverty and joblessness and homelessness. And as Dr. King once said, that protests, that's the voice of the inarticulate. When they don't feel like their voice is being heard, this is how they make themselves heard. The NAACP, also in August, during the same month of the time at the Watts riots, the NAACP had called for countries to revoke the visas of Mormon missionaries and to not allow them. And so the church is feeling really a lot of heat at this time with civil rights, and they're trying to, you know, put their toe in the water by reading this, you know, general statement in 1963. And the NAACP, they want the church and the Utah legislature to go further. But yet the leaders don't feel like they can go further because they have people who don't literally support civil rights. And this becomes a big issue.
What are the extent of the rumors? And how did they, as far as you can tell, how do they take off? I mean, so Reed Benson says this thing may happen, but it's like, you know, it's like the telephone game. You know, you start something and it really seems to take off. So what's the word on the street? How is this thing morphing into crazy stories?
We dodged the bullet. It didn't happen, but it could happen. And so both the church leaders and Utahns, or Latter-day Saints in Utah, I should say, are absolutely paranoid that black advocates are going to march to Salt Lake. And Benson had been predicting this for at least 4 or 5 years at this point. There's going to be violence. There's going to be bloodshed. And you see it gradually escalate as the 1960s moves on, and it will eventually culminate by 1970.
Hmm. So all of these rumors are swirling around. They didn't happen. They sort of fade away to some degree, although they're in the back of the minds of some church leaders, some church members themselves. And then they come up again, and then they come up again. And in October of 1967, you write about the fact that Ezra Taft Benson asks then-President David O. McKay if he could speak about civil rights at the October conference. And David O. McKay lets him. What happens?
Well, so it's kind of strange. You know, you don't typically go in and talk to the church president and get approval for your sermon, but Benson recognizes that, again, the Birch Society is controversial. There are racial tensions at this point. By 1967, there's a race riot in Detroit. There are other race disturbances around the country. And so Benson feels the need to address this to the church body. But knowing how controversial it is, he feels like he needs to get President McKay's support. He doesn't say what the sermon's about to President McKay. So President McKay just said, yes, if you're just going to talk about the civil rights movement, that's fine. You have my blessing. But certainly President McKay had no idea what Elder Benson was about to say.
So tell us what he says, because I have to say that looking at the text of this speech, in light of the fact that people were already feeling paranoid, there were already fears, there were already rumors out there. But looking at the speech, it seems crazy. What does he say?
Yeah, so he...
Now, by the way, this is at Mormon General Conference. I just want to underline that. He is speaking from the pulpit in the Salt Lake Tabernacle saying these things.
Yes. He says that the black radicals are going to create this communist program for revolution in America. And he lists three reasons how this will be so. He said the communists will create hatred. They will use means to agitate blacks into hating whites and whites into hating blacks, and to play up and exaggerate real grievances, even to the point of manufacturing false stories and rumors of injustices and brutality. If I can just pause for a moment, this is the very same thing that Reed was doing just a year and a half earlier, creating rumors and false stories. Hmm. Second, they will trigger violence. They'll form large mobs, Benson says. Third, they will seek to overthrow established government. Once mob violence becomes widespread and commonplace, the communists would condition those who are emotionally involved to accept violence as the only way to settle the score. They would gradually test their training through sporadic riots and battles with police. Then, at the appointed time, launch an all-out simultaneous offensive in every major city.
Wow. Well, hold on. That's crazy. Yes. So what he's saying is there is going to be a communist overthrow, and this is how it's going to play out. That's what he's telling members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in this conference.
That's correct. And then he proceeds to lay out the details about how these black radicals, these black Marxists, will proceed. They'll attack water supplies and power grids and railway lines and highway arteries and communication centers, and they'll bomb government buildings. And it just goes on and on and on. I try to imagine what it must have been like sitting in the tabernacle, listening to this sermon, that this was coming down the pike.
Let's talk about what happens in 1970. So again, we're sort of in this cycle. In 65, it seems to begin, it surges and it declines, and it surges and it declines. In 1970, you mentioned the rumors begin again that these, as you put it in your writing, armed black militants would bomb Temple Square during the April 1970 session of General Conference. Let's talk about this next burst of rumor.
So the context is, I'm going to take you back to April of 1968, and the church receives two bombshells, figuratively speaking, in April of 1968. One is that the federal government is going to investigate Brigham Young University, the church-owned and operated university. They're going to investigate them for alleged violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. BYU had three African-American students at the time, and that had connoted to the federal government that BYU had some racial policies that would prevent blacks from attending the school. And of course, the priesthood restriction made this all the more alarming. So they received notification from the Department of Justice that they're going to be investigated for their recruitment policies with both black students and black faculty, of which they had none. And then secondly, in April of 1968, the first athletic protest occurred at the University of Texas, El Paso, when UTEP athletes, some of them had identified as Black Power advocates, they had pledged to protest BYU sports because BYU is a racist institution, they said. And that was the first, this UTEP protest was the first of many dozens of protests that will occur from 1968 to 1971. And some of these protests are not just protests, like we're going to boycott, they turn violent. And of course, the church is horrified because now there's violence. These protests against the church's racial policies and teachings and BYU's racial policies are now turned violent. This is February of 1970. By April of 1970, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is rehearsing on Thursday in preparation for the conference that weekend. And as they're rehearsing, they get word from the security at the tabernacle that there's a bomb that's about to go off. And so they leave the tabernacle. And then that night, the Utah Symphony has its own rehearsal. Same thing. They get a call that there's a bomb that's going to go off. And Spencer Kimball and some of the other church leaders, Harold B. Lee, they're absolutely horrified that there's going to be a disruption by black militants at the conference.
So church leaders are bracing for some kind of disruption, possibly violence. What actually happens?
The first session on Saturday, it goes off without a hitch. And Apostle Kimball, he writes in his diary that night, you know, oh, we dodged the bullet. I'm so grateful that the God protected us and that we didn't have any incidences during the Saturday session. The Sunday session, the first session goes off without a hitch, and Elder Kimball is grateful. And the final session, as one of the general authorities is giving a talk called, "If You Are Prepared, Ye Shall Not Fear," appropriately enough. That was the title of the name of his talk, "If You Are Prepared, Ye Shall Not Fear," which is a second coming trope. As he's giving this talk, the church security officer hands a note to Harold B. Lee, who was conducting the meeting. And the note said that we've just received a bomb threat. Lee blows it off. He ignores it after all of this training. But he blows it off after all of these evacuation sessions they had done, the prayer meetings in the temple, the special meetings they had in the temple. He just ignores the threat. And they continue the conference. And Latter-day Saints are largely oblivious to what was occurring.
Let's come back to Ezra Taft Benson. He is, throughout this time, clearly stoking these kinds of rumors. What happens? Because you mentioned church leaders finally confront him and talk to him about the fact that he is harming the church. What happens in this time?
Well, so Harold B. Lee, who was the first counselor to Joseph Fielding Smith, he and President Smith were on the same page in terms of that Benson's Birch ideas and theories and conspiracy theories, they're harming the church. Latter-day Saints are upset. They're harming the church. And so they tell him that you are no longer permitted to talk about your Birch ideas in general conference. You're no longer permitted to attend Birch meetings. We don't want you talking about secret combinations and Gadianton robbers. Those are the buzzwords from the Book of Mormon to tropes to signify that there are secret people in government who are communists, right? So they tell him you can't do this. And Benson's really, really upset by this. And then later, Spencer W. Kimball, when he became the church president, he makes it very, very clear to Ezra Taft Benson that your ideas are harming the church. It's hard to grow the church in Black Africa, for example, if you're suggesting and asserting that Black people are fomented by communists. That's just not good. And then if you call people with whom you disagree, you know, Democrats and socialists and liberals, if you call them communists, you're hurting our missionary efforts in Northern Europe, for example, who love their socialist government. And so stop. Kimball tells him very, very clearly to stop. And to Benson's credit, he does, for the most part, he does stop after Kimball has to impose some sanctions on him, but he does eventually stop.
Matt Harris, he's a professor of history at Colorado State University. His most recent book is Watchmen on the Tower, Ezra Taft Benson and the Making of the Mormon Rite. Also, go check out our short film by Kelsey Moore. It's about the Utah race riot rumor. You can find it at RadioWest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks at what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about a story from Utah history, how a rumor took hold in 1965 and really stayed around for several years. And what makes this story all the more interesting is how you hear different versions of a race rumor today. Now, it's different in important ways, but the idea of political figures using fear as a tactic, that is tried and true. Joining us now on the program is LaShawn Williams. She is a licensed clinical social worker, an assistant professor at Utah Valley University. And we asked her to talk about how rumors of racial violence take hold and spread in a community.
What you're looking at is the evolution of communication from overt, blatant, negative, exploitative, and oppressive communications to what we call dog whistle politics. And you notice the shift most recently after the civil rights movement, when you had President Nixon promising to restore law and order. Similarly, in our most current campaign, you hear similar calls for law and order. And that's a dog whistle call for violence with immunity from states that are sanctioned against communities. And the type of environments that allow that to happen are the types that are rooted in fear. What you're looking at also is the failure of our society to develop a truly just and welcoming and inclusive identity. And this is all part of that process for how it manages crisis.
What is the fear exactly? How does it speak to a kind of, there's a stereotype here in play. What is that stereotype that these political figures are trying to exploit?
Safety. And it started with Birth of a Nation back in the early 19-teens, the influence of media to be able to really heavily affect the way we view each other. What you also have is, as Carol Anderson discusses, white rage, which is a fear of equality and a fear of what she terms Black advancement. And so what you're looking at is this, it's a fear of equality, which doesn't really make sense when you look at the foundation of our country. The words said liberty and justice for all and equality, but then our actions did not say that. So we're really caught in owning our hypocrisy. And so it's that fear that what if everything is equal? The fear is if there's equality for you, then there's not going to be fairness for me. And we really have to engage that, because those who feel like they have the most to lose are the most invested in protecting it by any means necessary. And that's when you have the dog whistle politics and the coded language that we're beginning to see creep up again.
There were these kinds of rumors, but different versions that were taking hold in other places around the country in the 1960s, this idea that the civil rights movement was a front for some communist revolution. But I wonder, what do you see as the distinctive feature about the Utah rumors? I mean, clearly the context here is the controversial racial policy by the LDS Church and racist ideas and theories by LDS leaders. How did Mormons put their own unique spin on this riot rumor?
It's curious. You know, it's very concerning because what you're running into is the promise, again, this hypocrisy that we have, all are alike unto God, and then the actions of protecting life, liberty, religion, family, etc., with, for the Mormon faith, Captain Moroni and the title of liberty. The question becomes, over whom does that title cover? And when we feel like liberty is only available to the groups that we belong to, then we start excluding other people. And what you have is this belief in man and this fear of change. So it's a unique double consciousness for the Mormon faith. Always understanding that the associations with the other, of truly bringing people into the fold, puts Mormonism's whiteness at risk of exclusion from America's whiteness. And so whatever efforts we can put forward to hold on to our membership in America's whiteness that Mormonism's whiteness has fought to hold on to, you're looking at exactly what Paul Reeve talks about in his book, Religion of a Different Color, is this fight within Mormonism for whiteness is a fight to belong and to uphold white supremacy, unfortunately.
It's interesting. One of the things you've mentioned is you were hearing references, particularly references that people who are not members of that faith would not understand, not familiar with the Book of Mormon, but references to like Gadianton robbers and like what were the kind of distinctive features there as well?
Oh, besides being mind-boggling, what you're looking at is the notion of secret combinations, people who plot for power in secret. And on its face, it doesn't match what you're actually seeing in the movement for Black Lives. These are plans and public requests for justice. These are invitations to join and to create policies that are actually fair. None of it, which is done in secret, which can't be said in the same way for some of the organizing against the Black Lives Matter movement, for some of the accusations that Antifa, this giant, faceless, leaderless movement, is actually at the root of all of the problems. But it doesn't bear out when you actually follow it to its most logical conclusion. So the idea that it's power hungry, again, you're going to come and take from me, which is completely, it's counterintuitive, because if you say that you have nothing with these notions of white privilege, power, et cetera, I don't have white privilege. Well, then what are you worried that's being taken from you if you don't have it? So it's the maneuverings and the slippery nature of protecting white supremacy. And it's this deep, deep cognitive dissonance that allows us to keep having these circular conversations about what is being taken from me, but that I refuse to admit that I actually have. I only do so when it's convenient for me.
What are you hearing in that may seem like an echo of the rumors that took hold in the 1960s today? Because I'm guessing you're going to hear people who are going to say, look, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has now changed its racial policy, that the racial ban in 1978, we're in a new world. But you're clearly seeing these same kinds of echoes in the kind of political strategy for today, it seems.
Yes. And it requires us to have, again, a more nuanced conversation. We can't continue saying that, forget what I said, forget what anyone said, forget what George Q. Cannon said, in order to quote Bruce R. McConkie after Official Declaration 2. We can't forget what people said if we haven't said why this needs to be forgotten. So forget what I said because it was wrong. And Bruce R. McConkie says, we spoke with limited light and knowledge. Great. So let's go back and let's be very, very clear of what that limited light and knowledge was. Because if you leave it up to people, the basis of confirmation bias is I'm going to look for things that fit what I already believe. And when we're living and working in a system that seeks balance, it's only going to evolve to maintain that balance. And it's not going to evolve into change. So if the balance is rooted in inequality and in injustice and in superiority and inferiority, then any movement to actually change the system means we have to get rid of that balance. So we have to be very clear about what it is we're saying that we're doing today. Looking forward is wonderful, but if we don't know where we've been, we can't really effectively chart a path forward. And so we have to have that nuanced conversation before 1978, back to the statements in the 1940s, and to say, this was wrong. And even if you say, I don't know what it looks like today, but I know that this was wrong and we have to do this thing differently, that is also an option.
So last weekend was the General Conference for the LDS Church, and President Russell Nelson made what I've seen described as a pretty powerful condemnation of racism. And he said this. He said, I call upon our members everywhere to lead out in abandoning attitudes and actions of prejudice. So you have that on one hand, but also still no actual apology for the past. It seems no willingness by leaders to reckon with that in the past. So what do you make of that comment in light of that?
I think the words that came right before that are the most important. He says, listen to me very carefully. There is no one race that is superior or inferior to another, and God does not put value of positive or negative on skin color. And I call on all members to lead out against the fight of racism, and that it grieved his heart that his Black brothers and sisters were suffering under racism and prejudice. Like, all of those words put together they may be very reminiscent of when President Hinckley did a similar request and says that any person who believes that they are better than another is not worthy to hold the priesthood. And it sounded like a number of us said, oh, well, those saints in the South, you know, they need to hear that. I don't know that we are as effectively committed to, oh, my goodness, I need to hear that. Am I guilty of this? It's that quintessential question, Lord, is it I? Because if we are betraying one another by seeing Black brothers and sisters experiencing racism, if Christ says to his disciples, before this evening is over, one of you will betray me, and they all ask, Lord, is it I? If the prophet says, I need you all to lead out against racism, and we say, Lord, is it I? President Nelson, is it I? How do I lead? That actually needs to become the question. That needs to become the action. It can't just be, he said it, it sounded good, and it's for everybody else. Every single member needs to be asking, how do I lead out against racism? Because that's not a passive statement. That's a, we take the lead and we go first to do this. The Mormons aren't the first ones to do it. There are a number of evangelical Christian preachers, Jewish rabbis, Muslim imams. There are other religious leaders who are doing the work of racial justice. But someone looking at Mormons because of this connection to whiteness and these cultural definitions that apply whiteness to Mormonism, and then utilize the priesthood and temple exclusion bans as evidence, there's a reason why we have to lead out in this effort. And every single member should be saying, Lord, is it I? President Nelson, what can we do? And how do we lead? Because that is what we are called to do.
So that's progress, you see. Or is it conditional from your perspective?
I think it's both. I think it's progress because we need to hear those words specifically. It's conditional because we might not ever get the words, I'm sorry for the role the church has had in perpetuating racism and prejudice against Black people and Black members in the church. So one of the things that the freedom movements in Black communities is used to is taking what is said and moving forward with it to make something happen. So I do think that it is the same kind of progress we're used to seeing so far as baby steps or crumbs instead of a full loaf. But we come from a people who can make a way out of no way. And so if we can take all these crumbs and make two loaves of bread and get a couple of fish, we might be able to feed the world and in feeding it, heal it.
LaShawn Williams. She's an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. And don't forget to go check out our short film by Kelsey Moore. It's about the Utah race riot rumor. You can find it at RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.